General joins the fight to protect public broadcasting. I'm Gracie J. What had been known as the XL Energy Center in downtown St. Paul will now be known as the Grand Casino Arena. Grand Casino Hinckley, owned by the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe, announced the 14-year naming rights partnership. The casino's chief executive officer says it represents the strength of tribal enterprise and the tribe's ongoing investment in Minnesota's future. You'll start seeing new signage by this fall. Next, a move in Congress to cancel already approved funding for public broadcasting has Minnesota's small radio stations on edge. Zan Holston has more.
Earlier this month, the U.S. House passed a rescission package, a rare budget maneuver that could claw back $1.1 billion from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, or CPB.
Taxpayer funding for woke media entities is absurd.
Critics have long targeted the CPB for what they call biased media from the Public Broadcasting Service, commonly known as PBS, and National Public Radio, known as NPR. But those national brands only receive a fraction of the CPB funds. More than 70% goes directly to smaller, non-commercial local television and radio stations. In Minnesota, most of them serve rural or tribal communities.
That's why I listen to Niji Radio like you do. You can hear music and other programs you don't hear on commercial radio.
KKWE, Niji Radio, is an independently operated Anishinaabe community station in Callaway in northwest Minnesota. Station manager Maggie Rosso said half the station's budget comes from the CPB, which helps pay for staffing 3 employees and buying radio programs.
We definitely seek out programming that fits our community and that's the community of White Earth Nation.
While stations are required to spend a portion of their CPB grants on national programming, there are sources beyond NPR, including Native Voice One. But the funding also helps them provide local reporting, like broadcasting their tribal executive committee meetings. Rosso said those local stories don't just reflect the community, they are the community. Losing those funds would cut right at the heart of who they are.
If we get hit, we get hurt.
We're not really the target. We're sort of collateral damage.
Mark Johnson is station manager at KSRQ in Thief River Falls.
Thank you for tuning in to Pioneer 90.1 Community Radio for the Northland.
About 30% of their budget comes from the CPB. That money covers the same essentials as a KKWE. It also helps the station qualify for state support, but only if it maintains 2 full-time equivalent staff. KSRQ has 2.5 employees.
Without the federal funding and therefore without the state funding, it is very difficult to see a way forward.
At KAXE in Grand Rapids and KBXE in Bagley, the story is a little different. Station director Sarah Bignall says they get 13% of their budget, about $200,000, from the CPB. But financials are only part of it. They also get technical support for emergency broadcasting systems and collaboration tools that let rural stations pool resources. Losing access to those services would be like losing
closer to $400,000 instead of just the $200,000 that we receive in actual cash money.
The rescission bill is expected to go to the U.S. Senate's Appropriation Committee in early July, where lawmakers could pass it, amend it, or let it stall. If the Senate takes no action, the rescission deal will expire on July 18th, and funding will go through as originally planned. But even if that happens, many in Congress are determined to prevent CPB from getting any new funding. For KSRQ's Johnson, the loss would be short-sighted. Funding the CPB costs each taxpayer less than half a penny a day.
It's a tremendous value. I mean, I just think that there are very few things that are a better deal than $1.60 for all of public broadcasting.
For North Star Stories, I'm Zan Holston.
It should be noted that Ampers produces North Star Stories and is responsible for its content. Ampers helps to support 17 community radio stations, including those mentioned in the report you just heard. Ampers itself does not receive funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. In a related story, Minnesota's Attorney General has joined 21 others in filing a brief with the U.S. Supreme Court supporting public broadcasting. In late May, National Public Radio and 3 public stations in Colorado sued to prevent the Trump administration from eliminating federal funding. The friend of the court brief argues that cuts to public broadcasting will create risks to public safety by disrupting the distribution of emergency information.
North Star Stories is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ampers.org.
Today, the latest on the school dress code debate in Forest Lake. Then, recent incidents have some communities concerned about identifying who is really a law enforcement officer. And Minneapolis rolls out a new tool to crack down on dangerous driving. I'm Chantel Sings. The Forest Lake School Board delayed a vote to change its dress code, which currently bans hate symbols. The decision comes despite months of protests from students and parents. The dress code, which bans swastikas, Confederate flags, and KKK signs, dates back to a racist assault of a black student in the 1990s. Some fear removing that language is a backdoor way to target pride flags, Black Lives Matter symbols, and LGBTQ expression. The board sent the issue back to committee with instructions to either eliminate the specific language or create a full list of banned symbols. For now, the current policy stays in place. The board is expected to discuss the issue again this fall. In today's main story, recent shootings targeting state lawmakers and the actions of federal agents have created a climate of concern among Minnesotans, particularly among people in the immigrant and undocumented communities. Jose Osoria has more.
As ICE agents have been conducting raids throughout Minnesota, wearing masks to conceal their identity, a climate of concern exists among Minnesotans, particularly those in the immigrant and undocumented community.
When ICE agents show up with their faces covered, the message is that this inhuman machine has come to get you or to come to take away your loved one.
Tom Haig is the chair of the board of ICOM, Interfaith Coalition on Immigration. He says Minnesotans are even more concerned now because the gunman who shot House Speaker Emerita Melissa Hortman, as well as her husband, and seriously wounded State Senator John Hoffman and his wife, wore a mask and was impersonating a police officer.
Especially in Minnesota, I think that's a really valid, reasonable objection. People show up, they're masked, their vehicle is unmarked, they don't show any identification. People have a right to be nervous and afraid.
Open the car. Just unlock the door.
The concern in Minnesota is so significant, given the attacks on the legislators, that several police departments around the state have taken to social media to tell residents how to identify legitimate officers. Acting ICE Director Todd Lyons is a strong proponent of ICE agents wearing masks.
Is that the issue here, that we're just upset about the masks?
Director Lyons says there's a good reason why federal officers are covering their faces and maintaining their anonymity.
People are out there taking photos of the names, their faces, and posting them online with death threats to their family and themselves.
Sarah Adams, aid program director with Interfaith Coalition on Immigration, says that given some of the things that immigrants and undocumented Minnesotans have fled their countries of origin for, masked raids are additionally terrifying.
Obviously, there's a problem if you are being approached on a street by someone who's wearing a mask. And a lot of the people in the communities are in the United States fleeing governments where those types of things happen. And then to come to this country and face it all over again is really frightening.
Ms. Adams points out that the intimidation associated with the masked raids has created a fear that is palpable within the community.
That huge level of fear and this attempt to just stay home, obviously that means some people will try to not go to work. Other people obviously feel like they have to, but it's other places as well. People don't want to go shopping. People don't even necessarily want to go to their place of worship.
Acting ICE Director Lyons believes that when it comes to his officer safety, the ends justify the means.
So I'm sorry if people are offended by them wearing masks, but I'm not going to let my officers and agents go out there and put their lives on the line and their family on the line because people don't like what immigration enforcement is.
Hey, you fight with me. Don't fight with me, all right? Don't fight with me. All right, put your hand behind your back, all right?
For North Star Stories, I'm Jose Osoria.
You are listening to North Star Stories. Minneapolis drivers could start seeing tickets from automated traffic cameras as soon as September. The city is launching a four-year, $12 million pilot program to test speed enforcement cameras targeting five high-risk intersections near schools. Offenders could get warnings, $40 fines, and higher penalties for higher speed violations. The full city council needs to give final approval. A public information campaign starts next month with details on camera locations and how enforcement will work. The program could expand to include red light violations and up to 42 cameras around the city.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota. Online at ambers.org.
In today's stories, a new strain of COVID with a primary symptom you should know about. Then, a Minnesota family celebrates a Supreme Court victory and a new program to help Native youth get in shape. I'm Gracie J. The feeling that you're swallowing razor blades is often how people describe strep throat. Now, experts are saying that's a signature symptom for the new strain of COVID-19. Doctors say that as the virus evolves, our body's response to it changes as well, and that could explain the changing symptoms. The Minnesota Department of Health says if you are recovering from COVID, you should stay home and stay away from others until your symptoms are getting better and you are fever-free for at least 24 hours. You can find more information about protecting yourself from the new strain of COVID on the Department of Health's website. Next, a Minnesota family's fight for their daughter's accommodations for her disability ended at the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, because of their case, students with disabilities across the country have stronger protections under the Americans with Disabilities Act. Catherine Dussel has the story.
Thanks to a Minnesota family, students with disabilities across the country now have the same protections as anyone else covered by the Americans with Disabilities Act, or ADA.
We moved to Minnesota in 2015.
That's Aaron Tharp. The Tharp family had been advocating for their daughter, Ava, for the past 10 years. Ava has epilepsy and often experiences seizures early in the day. When the family moved to Osseo, a suburb of the Twin Cities, they asked the school district for a modified schedule.
We sent Ava's IEP to the school district. We were led to believe that they would adopt the Kentucky IEP the day before school started. The school district decided that it would not adopt the IEP and they reduced Ava's services.
An IEP, or Individualized Education Program, is a legally mandated document under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, or IDEA. It outlines a student's specific special education services tailored to their needs. This disagreement over Ava's schedule and her right to accommodations ultimately led to a legal challenge, which went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. Lawyer Nick Rossellini with the law firm Latham & Watkins explains his case.
There was this rule floating around in the lower courts that had this, we think, make-believe, made-up standard that basically said children with disabilities have to actually clear a higher standard than anyone else suing under the Americans with Disabilities Act. So it's harder for children with disabilities to prove their ADA claims than it is for any other plaintiff.
The U.S. Supreme Court receives thousands of petitions to hear cases each year, but only takes on a small fraction of them. Ava's father, Aaron.
It's extraordinary for the Supreme Court to take any case. Are they taking 50, 60 some cases a year? We knew it was a very difficult argument to make, but we were hopeful.
During the Supreme Court hearing, the legal question revolved around whether children with disabilities had to prove schools were discriminating against them. As attorney Rossellini explains, that's a higher standard than other ADA cases.
When you lay out what this rule is, oh, kids with disabilities, they have to clear a higher standard than anybody else. I think most people would hear that and be like, why? That seems very odd and unfair.
And the U.S. Supreme Court agreed. They ruled unanimously that the rule was unfair.
Children with disabilities in Minnesota and the rest of the country now get the same fair shot at proving their claims as anyone else with a disability.
Ava's father, Aaron.
My hope is that school districts take this moment to do better.
In a statement in response to the ruling, Osseo Public School District says that it is committed to educating and providing needed services for every student. For North Star Stories, I'm Catherine Dussel.
You are listening to North Star Stories. A $330,000 grant is helping Native American girls hit their stride. The Shakopee Mattawakutun Sioux community is teaming up with the nonprofit Girls on the Run to engage Native girls in grades 3 through 8 in fitness and leadership programs. The money will support outreach and training for coaches and cover the program costs for up to 600 Native girls over the next 3 years. The partnership is part of Shakopee's Indigifit Kids, a $6 million campaign promoting health and well-being for Native youth through culturally informed programs.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
In today's broadcast, how you can help residents of northern Minnesota impacted by the recent storms. Then, why a graduate of McAllister College is suing the school. And a new outdoor concert venue is coming to the Twin Cities. I'm Chantel Sings. Residents in and around the Bemidji area are still dealing with the aftermath of a major storm that left the path of destruction behind. The National Weather Service says the storm in late June brought wind gusts between 100 and 120 miles per hour. That's the equivalent of between a Category 2 and a Category 3 hurricane. Emergency managers want to remind those still repairing the damage to get multiple estimates from reputable contractors and make sure they're insured and licensed with the City of Bemidji. Listeners who want to help storm victims should contact the United Way of Bemidji. Ahead, an alumnus of McAllister College in St. Paul recently sued the private college for unethical use of rats in their psychology labs. Reporter Kylie Kendall has all the details of the lawsuit.
An alumnus of McAllister College is suing the school to try and stop them from using live rats for psychology experiments. Dr. Neil Barnard graduated from McAllister in 1975 with a degree in psychology. While planning for his class reunion, he discovered the school was still conducting what he called unnecessary and cruel animal experiments.
Ones that I had been involved in 50 years ago and that had been invented probably 50 years before that, they were still ongoing.
But the problem wasn't just that these methods were still being used.
Most disturbingly, that the college was being less than honest about it. It publicly says that they use the highest ethical standards.
Those standards prohibit using animals if there's an alternative. Barnard says there are plenty of other options. Barnard accuses the institution of using Skinner boxes. When asked for a response, McAllister said in a written statement that they do use conditioning chambers, but not specifically Skinner boxes, since Skinner boxes imply use of electrical shocks. Barnard said the method is still outdated.
I've heard from psychologists, I've heard from veterinarians, I've heard from people who have said, I can't believe this is still happening in this day and age.
Barnard spoke to a former classmate and was shocked to find out what was happening 50 years ago was still happening today.
He said, you guys don't know what goes on here. And he said, first of all, to make them perform, I have to starve them. They have to be really hungry or really thirsty, because otherwise they're not going to perform for you.
And it doesn't stop there.
I take each one, throw them in a trash can, one on top of the other, alive, on top of the other, and then I pour chloroform over the top, and I close the lid.
After current psychology students confirmed to Barnard these practices are still used, he eventually spoke with the college president about the issue and was hopeful.
Then out of the blue, I got a message from her saying, we have no desire for any further contact or any discussion on this issue. If you have any other comments on it, please go to this attorney.
That's when Barnard knew he had to do something more.
I have to say, I thought, all right, let's make sure that you do deal with this. And so I'm bringing them to court.
With the help of Barnard's nonprofit, the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, he put up two billboards around the college, along with a mobile billboard at his reunion, which he did not attend.
Saying basically, Stanford and Yale and Penn, don't do this. Mac, when are you going to get with it?
When asked for a comment on the story, McAllister provided us with a statement that said the college adheres to all ethical standards and that their programs do use a small number of rats and mice, but are overseen by an animal ethics committee. They do not allow external parties to interfere with or dictate their curriculum. But Barnard said he has not heard from them yet.
I have seen nothing from the college on this at all. So a court date will be set and will be heard.
Barnard is requesting the college return his $100 donation, a declaration that the college violated the law, and for the school to stop using animals in the labs, or if they continue to use them, to take down the statement saying they adhere to the highest ethical standards.
I just hope for the animals and for the students, and frankly for good science. I hope we win soon.
This is Kylie Kendall for North Star Stories.
You are listening to North Star Stories. An outdoor music venue is set to come to North Minneapolis right along the Mississippi River. That's thanks to a $12.5 million grant from the state. It's part of a larger redevelopment plan that includes a new park, housing, and a performing arts center in the coming years. Some Northside residents and advocates have expressed ongoing concern. They question who the amphitheater will benefit. The city, however, has published a detailed racial equity analysis. The venue's construction timeline has yet to be announced.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
Today, a new mine that will bring more than 300 new jobs to the Iron Range. Then, a new shopping center hopes to become a multicultural hub in St. Paul. And why electric vehicle drivers are going to start paying more to own their cars. I'm Gracie J. A new taconite mine is expected to bring 350 new jobs to the Iron Range in northern Minnesota. 20 years in, Mesabi Metallics' $2.4 billion Nashwauk taconite mine is nearly ready to open. Delays and financial troubles hampered the mine's completion for years, but the company said construction is 80% complete and that it expects to be up and running in about 6 months. The announcement comes months after the neighboring Hibtac mine partially shut down due to weak demand from steelmakers. Mesabi's CEO says he's confident the new mine will have buyers for its ore. Up next, a new Pan-Asian center in the Twin Cities is hoping to create a hub that will bring together the community and small businesses. Reporter Jama Jama takes us there.
Located 10 minutes from downtown St. Paul, a new space is coming to life, and it's aiming to blend culture and commerce. The Pan-Asian Center is now open in the former Macy's and Sears buildings at Maplewood Mall. It's giving new life to areas of the mall that have sat vacant for more than 5 years. The multi-purpose hub will offer everything from handmade goods to authentic cuisine.
We are building this as a community rather than a shopping mall.
Tua Xiong, a Hmong entrepreneur, came up with the idea and set out to create a space unlike any other.
This is not a mall. This is a one-stop shopping. Whether you're thinking about food is here. Whether you're thinking about kids' play is here. Whether you're thinking about cultural colors, cultural things is here. Whether you're talking about...
Tua also saw an opportunity to create a business hub that many Asian immigrants sorely needed. And Minnesota is home to over 240,000 Asian residents.
Culturally, because of the cultural differences, a lot of these people who are thinking about doing business may not be comfortable. But then they are a community, they need to make a living. This is the main purpose why this mall is happening the way it is.
Tua also owns and operates Hmong Town, which he opened in 2004, a beloved shopping hub with more than 100 vendors. Now, he's hoping to design a gathering place for the community and is looking to offer much more than just merchandise.
So at the same time that we're designing, we're also starting to look for vendors, tenants, or artists to showcase their work. Not just Hmong, but we're talking about Somali, Nepal, Karen, all those communities working together to bring foot traffic to this mall.
Right now, the Pan-Asian Center is open for shopping. Independent shopkeepers have set up inside and offer everything from home decor to beauty products.
The Pan-Asian Center is a space that was recently brought into my community. It provided a lot of opportunity, space to start your own business, to start your own dream. That was kind of the idea. We like being here because we get to experience cultures from all aspects of life.
For shopkeepers like Sensei, the Pan-Asian Center is a huge help in starting out with a new business. And that's exactly what Tua is hoping for.
Please do not think this is just an Asian shopping center. This is an opportunity for people of any color. It will be a very vibrant destination. It will be a place to go to. It will be a place for you to bring your friends or families.
The Pan-Asian Center is hoping to fully open by 2027. For North Star Stories, I'm Jama Jama.
You are listening to North Star Stories. As gas tax revenues decline, Minnesota's lawmakers say electric vehicle drivers can expect to start paying more. Starting next year, EV drivers will see their registration fees double, jumping to at least $150, and the hike will hit more expensive cars harder. Plug-in hybrid drivers will also see an increase to their yearly renewals. Lawmakers say the fees will only be temporary. Starting in 2027, some costs will shift when a new tax on public fast charging stations goes into effect.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
This is Minnesota Native News. I'm Murray Rock. This week, we hear how the recent federal spending bill impacts tribal colleges and universities. Then, cousins Travis and Sam Zimmerman share about their book, How the Birds Got Their Songs. First, reporter Zan Holston has more about the federal budget impacts to higher education for tribal colleges.
When Red Lake Nation Hereditary Chief Dan King first heard about potential 40% cuts to tribal colleges and universities, he was upset but not surprised.
We're usually the first to get cut on any cuts and then the last to get added, you know, when there's a new program.
Chief King is also president of Red Lake Nation College, one of the 32 accredited tribal colleges and universities, or TCUs, in the U.S. But President Trump's proposed 2026 budget went even further, slashing money for TCUs by a staggering 83%.
It's the federal Indian grant massacre of 2025.
TCUs are often the only colleges in rural areas. They combine cultural knowledge with academics and help preserve indigenous languages and history. Because they serve many working parents, even the threat of cuts can bring uncertainty, lower enrollment, and stalled programming.
We are the hubs and the lifelines of our communities.
That's Anna Wake Rose, president of AHEC, the American Indian Higher Education Consortium. She said TCUs offer far more than degrees.
Oftentimes, we're the only library in our community. We're the only Head Start program in our community. We're training teachers. We're training nurses.
Rose said most TCUs offer low or no-cost education, helping students graduate debt-free, ready to transfer to four-year schools or enter the workforce. Chief King said that last year, Red Lake Nation College recorded a 52% graduation rate. That's 10% higher than the average for two-year public universities, according to the National Center for Education Statistics. The new fiscal year starts October 1st, but the budget package cutting TCU funding still needs congressional approval. Chief King expects funding to be restored, but if not, he's prepared to take it to court. AHEC's president, Anna Wake Rose, doesn't think it will have to go that far.
We're going to be working a lot with our congressional allies to ensure that TCUs are funded, but we don't ever want to see this type of budget proposal again.
For Minnesota Native News, I'm Zan Holston.
Next, reporter Dan Ninham spoke with author and artist duo Sam and Travis Zimmerman about their collaborative children's book.
I found these stories that my dad had written down, but because they were in pencil, they were disintegrating off the page.
That's Travis Zimmerman, author of How the Birds Got Their Songs, an Ojibwe and English dual language children's book, published in 2024. Travis wanted to share these stories with the next generation.
It'd be great to honor my great-grandma, because they're her stories. But also, you know, I was thinking about my dad getting up in age, and, you know, he's at that time 81. And then at the same time, I have a couple grandkids, so it was also, you know, in my mind, what kind of gift can I leave the next generation?
So he invited his cousin, artist and author, Sam Zimmerman, to collaborate.
Sam had already illustrated several children's books and written his own book by that time, so it just seemed a natural connection to really kind of make it a family project.
And so in reading the story and speaking with my dad about it, you know, and he's like, this is a great way to, you know, not only honor our grandfather and his mother, our great-grandmother, but this is also a great way to preserve language. You know, Ojibwe, our language is an endangered language, and there's a resurgence on language revitalization and preservation. And so, yeah, I got to work.
Over the past year, the Zimmerman cousins have toured How the Birds Got Their Songs across Minnesota. The book tour has included events from painting tutorials to classroom read-alouds in English and Anishinaabe Mon.
When Mother Earth was very young, and the Great Spirit had created all the beings.
In the future, Travis and Sam hope to collaborate to share another story.
We are thinking about doing another one. We're going to do a story with animals.
To access the book, audiobook, and more events, go to mnhs.org. For Minnesota Native News, I'm Dan Ninham.
Minnesota Native News is produced by AMPERS, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota.
I'm a Veterans Court Mentor for Carver County.
This is Beyond Active Duty, Caring for Those Who Served, a series exploring the challenges Minnesota's veterans face, as well as the opportunities and services available to them.
My name is Major General Joanna Clyborne. I am retired. I was the Assistant Adjutant General for the state of Minnesota, Minnesota National Guard. I am also an attorney at Brecke, Clyborne, and Ribbage, where I work with military families. The various court systems have set up what we call rehabilitative courts. So the Veterans Court Projects takes a team approach to this veteran. That veteran is also assigned a mentor. So I've been helping as a female in the Veterans Court process for female veterans who've gone through. One of the things, we have someone with the County Service Veteran Officer that works with the MNDVA to ensure the benefits, because some of these individuals don't even think they qualify, but they just need someone to help them through that process. And so a lot of the services are actually provided for